This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and welcome to another edition of Did You Know?
This is Parra Tallis, and this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience.
And this is Bob Martin. I came across this very interesting fact this week.
Keep still, my beating heart.
It wasn't about anatomy. It was about history.
We wait with bated breath.
You can catch fish with your breath?
Bob, we just mean that we're waiting to hear what you've learned.
Sometimes you guys sure do talk funny.
Must be something in the environment.
And some people don't believe in global warming. Well, anyway, guess what King George III of England wrote in his diary on July 4th, 1776?
Probably something nasty about those ungrateful colonists.
Maybe not. At the speed of communications, he wouldn't have known about it yet. So, something about an act of Parliament?
No. He wrote, "Nothing of importance happened today."
Was he in for a surprise?
That was a specific event. But I think what Bob is getting at is, how many days are there when something of great significance might have occurred, but we see it just as a day of no importance?
Good point. So let's pick a date, any old date, and see if we can think of anything significant about it.
Okay. Think of a number between 1 and 10.
4.
5.
4 and 5 add up to 9. So, that makes it September. Now, there's a calendar behind you. Each of you close your eyes and point to a date.
I picked the 6th.
I pointed at the 10th.
That makes the 16th.
Very scientific, Bob.
Well, we have to be very careful that we're random. Now, the year. Look at the clock. Where is the second hand?
At 19 seconds.
19 seconds. That gives us the 19. And now for you, Kurt.
Okay, 5 seconds have gone by, so 24.
Since you and Parra are different, boy and girl, you know, we'll put you on the opposite side of the clock at, that makes it 54.
I don't follow that.
Chaos theory, Kurt. Remember the butterfly effect?
What?
Now we have our date, September 16th, 1954. Can you think of anything of significance that happened that day?
I can't.
Neither can I, but, let's check our historical date book. All right, let's see here. On September 16th, 1630, the settlement of Shawmut was renamed Boston.
Oh, what's in a name? A settlement by any other name might smell as sweet as the Kansas City stockyards.
Let me see that. On September 16th, 1908, Esperanto was first taught at a college.
And never got much further than the classroom.
Okay, in 1987, 24 nations signed the Montreal Protocols for protecting the ozone layer.
But nothing in 1954?
And you know what that proves.
Wait a minute. If I could interrupt just a minute. I was born on September 16th, 1954.
Nothing of importance happened that day.
I said I was born on that date, and it's important to me.
But have you done anything important?
I wrote a book.
Oh, yeah, one entitled Love, Romance, and Love Letters, A Guide for the Romantically Challenged Male.
I've written songs.
That's right. He wrote one for our Mother's Day program, and he's written one called Take My Arm, which is going to be the theme for a new TRS broadcast by the same name.
I sing with the band.
Just last Saturday night, as a matter of fact.
I'm president of the board of the Triangle Radio Reading Service.
And look how we've grown in the past few years.
Well, maybe a few little things, but nothing like tuning a piano, now is it? All in all, I still have to say, nothing of importance happened that day.
Bob, you sound like a curmudgeon.
What's that?
A sourpuss, a crosspatch, a crotchety old man.
Well, sometimes, Parra. But maybe it's just someone with a cynical point of view. And George Bernard Shaw once said, "The power of accurate observation is commonly called cynicism by those who have not got it."
You mean like a Pollyanna looks at life through rose-colored glasses while Lana said, "I love mankind. It's people I can't stand."
You got it.
Besides, old women can be crotchety too.
What?
She said crotchety old man. I'm just sticking up for women's rights.
Good for you, Bob. Equal time for curmudgeon.
September 16, 1954 is still my birthday, and something of importance did happen that day.
Hey, that gives me a great idea.
To celebrate Richard's birthday?
To make it a day of significance. Let's declare September 16th National Curmudgeon's Day.
I don't know about that.
Oh, an interesting idea.
Sure. We can look at some lives of famous curmudgeons, have some curmudgeon bell ringers, and even celebrate with a curmudgeon's birthday cake.
Let's do it. We'll see what Richard thinks about his special day later.
Where do we start?
At the beginning. A.
What does A stand for?
Anything you choose. How about abstract art?
What is abstract art?
A product of the untalented, sold by the unprincipled to the totally bewildered. Al Cap.
And it can't stand for advertising. Advertising may be described as the science of arresting human intelligence long enough to get money from it. Stephen Lee Cock.
I get it. How about an acquaintance? Someone you know well enough to borrow money from, but not well enough to lend money to. Ambrose Bierce.
And on to B. The Bible. The Bible tells us to love our neighbors. It also tells us to love our enemies, probably because they are the same people. G.K. Chesterton.
Bigamy. Bigamy is having one wife too many. Monogamy is the same thing. Oscar Wilde.
Babies. Anyone who hates kids and dogs can't be all bad. W.C. Fields.
How about a pause for W.C. Fields?
He sure fits the bill as curmudgeon.
Fields was born William Claude Duckenfield in Philadelphia in 1880. He was raised above a saloon where his father tended bar.
His mother was a strong woman, bitter about her life, and he probably inherited his wisecracking side-of-the-mouth comments from her. She would sit on the porch with her young son and keep him entertained with a running commentary about any of the neighbors who passed by.
Thus, immediately proving that old women can be crotchety. Some stories claim that Fields ran away from home after a fight with his father. He didn't. He left amiably to earn his fortune in show business at age 11.
He developed a great facility for juggling and taught himself routines and developed sight gags involving hats, golf clubs, and pool cues. One of his most famous involved cigar boxes, which he performed in film under the stage name The Great McGonagall.
He married Harriet Hughes in 1900. They lived together for 7 years and had one son. They separated and never reconciled. He subordinated his family, his social life, and ultimately his happiness to the demands of his career and turned his personal tragedies into comedy.
Out of such backgrounds comes the curmudgeon. In Fields' films, the characters that appear most often are a bratty son, a shrewish wife, a domineering mother-in-law, and a loving daughter. The kind of daughter which he never had.
In spite of his image as an imbiber of impious intoxicants, a befriender of beatific beverages, a connoisseur of comforting concoctions, Fields was a teetotaler during his juggling days.
To do otherwise was to mess up his timing.
The legendary drinking came from his loneliness. He often secured the companionship of other performers by offering free whiskey.
But once he caught the bug, so to speak, he would consume about a quart of gin a day.
He played himself in most of his pictures. Lovable rogues, bumming dipsomaniacs, harassed family men played by domineering wives and mother-in-laws. He died on Christmas Day in 1946. While confined to a bed during his last illness, he was caught reading a Bible. He commented, "Just looking for loopholes."
Contrary to legend, he isn't buried in Philadelphia. The famous quote, "All things considered, I'd rather be in Philadelphia," came from an article he wrote for Vanity Fair. His remains are in a simple urn in Forest Lawn in Glendale, California. How about some W.C. Fields zingers?
Okay, but before we start, let's go back to the first quote we had from him.
You mean, anyone who hates kids and dogs can't be all bad?
As much as it has become identified with him, he didn't say it.
Who did?
Spoken as a tribute to Fields at a banquet in 1939 by Leo Rosten, who was probably quoting it himself from an earlier article by someone else.
But did he say anything like it?
Anyone who hates dogs and loves whiskey can't be all bad.
Madam, there is no such thing as a tough child. If you parboil them first for 7 hours, they'll always come out tender.
When a man lies, steals, and cheats, but hates children, there must be some good in him.
And to other areas, a woman drove me to drink. I've never thanked her for it.
My illness is due to my doctor's insistence that I drink milk, a whitish fluid that they force down the throats of helpless babies.
I have no sympathy for a man who is intoxicated all the time. If he's intoxicated all the time, he doesn't need sympathy.
I keep spirits around just in case of snake bite.
I keep a snake for the same reason.
That reminds me of a story I once heard about Fields, and this is the way I might imagine him telling it. I was traveling down the road one day. My man was behind a wheel, and I was in the back seat having a martini. You know what a martini is? That's a bottle of gin in one hand and a bottle of vermouth in the other. As I looked out the window, I saw a man hitchhiking, thumb in the air, seeking transportation without pecuniary means to barter with. Here he was, a knight of the open road, without a chariot. So I said to my man, pull over and give the gentleman some transportational assistance. I opened the door and he got in, and then I discovered that he was a temperance preacher. Black frock coat, Bible under one arm, obviously used for thumping. I surveyed him. He looked at me. As my man started off down the road, he said, I usually don't do this for nothing, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception. And he proceeded to give me number 39 in the book, entitled On the Evils of Drink, all 27 chapters, with consequent emphases, including the sections in red print. When he finished, I said to my man, pull to the side of the road, to which request he quickly complied. I opened the door, and placing my right foot firmly on his vertebral column between the third and fourth sternum attachments, I facilitated his exit. As he lay there, I said, I usually don't do this for nothing, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception. I threw him a bottle of gin, which landed firmly in his solar plexus. This is number 51 in my book on how to stay warm in a ditch.
And with that, when life throws you lemons, make whiskey sours.
While traveling through Afghanistan, we lost our corkscrew. We had to live on food and water for several days.
I didn't squawk about the steak, dear. I merely said that I didn't see the old horse that used to be tied outside.
A rich man is nothing but a poor man with money.
Someone once commented that it must be hard to lose your mother-in-law. I replied, yes, it is. Very difficult, almost impossible.
There comes a time in the affairs of man when he has to take the bull by the tail and face the situation.
And we move on to subjects beginning with C. In California, everyone is going to a therapist, is a therapist, or is a therapist going to a therapist. Truman Capote.
Children, by the time the youngest children have learned to keep tidy, the oldest grandchildren are on hand to tear it to pieces. Christopher Morley.
College football would be more interesting if the faculty played it instead of the students. There would be a great increase in broken arms, legs, and necks. H.L. Mencken.
On decency. Decency must be an even more exhausting state to keep than its opposite. Those who succeed seem to need a stupefying amount of sleep. Quentin Crisp.
Democracy, the substitution of the election by the incompetent for appointment by the corrupt few. George Bernard Shaw.
On dogs. If you pick up a starving dog and make him prosperous, he will not bite you. This is the principal difference between a dog and a man. Mark Twain.
Existence. The very purpose of existence is to reconcile the glowing opinion we have of ourselves with the appalling things that other people think about us. Quentin Crisp.
Existentialism means that no one else can take a bath for you. Delmore Swartz.
Epitaphs. This would be a good thing for them to cut on my tombstone. Wherever she went, including here, it was against her better judgment. Dorothy Parker.
How about a look at Dorothy Parker?
See? A crotchety old woman.
Unfortunately, also a wit which was bred out of a life of unhappiness. She was born Dorothy Rothschild in 1893 in New Jersey to a Jewish father and a Scottish-American mother.
Her mother died in her infancy, and when her father remarried, she was raised by a stepmother who sent her to a Roman Catholic convent school and later to a private finishing school.
So much for her family life. She started her literary career as a caption writer for Vogue and went on to Vanity Fair as a reviewer with Robert Benchley as her editor. Eventually, she was fired because her reviews were too tough, and Benchley quit in support of her.
She was part of a group that assisted in the founding of the New Yorker magazine and became its drama critic. She also went on to become a screenwriter in Hollywood, but was always most known for what some called her caustic wit.
Or maybe it was just a case of social observance that others didn't have.
Dorothy often vented her contempt for pretension and self-importance on Claire Booth Luce. When told that Mrs. Luce was always kind to her inferiors, Dorothy said,
"Where does she find them?"
She once met Mrs. Luce as they both simultaneously started to enter a nightclub. Mrs. Luce stepped back and said, "Age before beauty."
"And pearls before swine."
When her husband, Alan Campbell, died, his body was being taken out of their home when a woman came gushing up to Dorothy and said, "Is there anything I can do for you?"
"Yes, get me a new husband."
I dare say that is the most callous, disgusting remark I've ever heard.
"Okay, then run down to the corner and get me a ham and cheese on rye and tell them to hold the mayo."
When told that Calvin Coolidge had died,
"How could they tell?"
If you want to know what God really thinks about money, just look at the people he gave it to.
The best way to keep children home is to make the home atmosphere pleasant and let all of the air out of the tires.
When asked about the Algonquin Round Table, the gathering of critics, writers, wits, and assorted others of which she was a charter member, along with Robert Benchley, George S. Kaufman, she said, "The Round Table thing was greatly overrated. It was full of people looking for a free lunch and asking, 'Did you hear the funny thing I said yesterday?'"
The cure for boredom is curiosity. There is no cure for curiosity.
"I don't care what is written about me as long as it isn't true."
That woman can speak 18 languages and can't say no in any of them.
And perhaps her most famous line, "Men seldom make passes at girls who wear glasses."
And to F. Fashion is a form of ugliness so intolerable that we have to alter it every 6 months. Oscar Wilde.
Own families. Having a family is like having a bowling alley installed in your brain. Martin Mull.
A fishing rod is a stick with a hook on one end and a fool at the other. Samuel Johnson.
On genius. When a true genius appears in the world, you may know him by this sign, that all the dunces are in confederacy against him. Jonathan Swift.
On glamour. Any girl can look glamorous. All she has to do is stand still and look stupid. Hedy Lamarr.
Gratitude is merely the secret hope for future favors. Francois de la Rochefoucauld.
On happiness. Few people can be happy unless they hate some other person, nation, or creed.
On health. The only way to keep your health is to eat what you don't want, drink what you don't like, and do what you'd rather not. Mark Twain.
In heaven, all interesting people are missing. Nietzsche.
Two things are infinite, the universe and human stupidity. And I'm not sure about the universe. Albert Einstein.
On insanity. A perfectly rational adjustment to the insane world. R.D. Lang.
On institutions. Marriage is a wonderful institution, but who wants to live in an institution? Groucho Marx. Okay, my turn to choose. I choose Groucho.
Groucho is a curmudgeon?
What would you call someone who has a secret word, and if you happen to say it, you get to visit with a duck?
But he made such funny movies.
Yes, he did. But there was also a bite to a lot of what he said. A bite that often pointed out a truth that you sometimes try to ignore.
And that's the job of a curmudgeon.
And it's a talent that also seemed to come from his childhood. Born Julius Henry Marx in 1890 in a section of Manhattan.
His father was an unsuccessful tailor who was nicknamed Frenchie, and his mother was an archetypal stage mother named Minnie. He was the third of five sons.
And he used to say that he was also third in his mother's affections. She referred to him as the Dark One.
Which may have accounted for his nickname, Groucho.
He and his brothers were on the stage by the time Julius was 11, and they struggled through vaudeville until their first big hit, a musical revue entitled, I'll Say She Is, From there, it was on to the coconuts.
Which also was made into a movie.
Right, and their notorious Day at the Races, A Night at the Opera, Horse Feathers, and others. Grouch ended his career as the host of You Bet Your Life on television.
Where he talked to the duck.
One insight given of him, he was an optimist disguised as a cynic. He was incapable of carrying on a serious conversation, always making fun of everything and everyone. His brother Chico said that he would make fun of a king to make a beggar laugh.
Maybe not so much a grouch at all, but someone who saw things as they are, not as they seem.
And so, some Groucho sayings. My mother loved children. She would have given anything if I would have been one.
Politics is the art of looking for trouble, finding it everywhere, diagnosing it incorrectly, and applying the wrong remedies.
The secret of life is honesty and fair dealing. Fake that, and you've got it made.
Why should I care about posterity? What has posterity ever done for me?
There is one way to find out if a man is honest. Ask him. If he says yes, you know he's a crook.
One morning I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got in my pajamas, I'll never know.
Why, even a 4-year-old child could understand this report. Run out and find me a 4-year-old child. I can't make head nor tail of it.
Who are you going to believe, me or your eyes?
Military intelligence is a contradiction in terms.
And military justice is to justice as military music is to music.
Whoever called it necking was a poor judge of anatomy.
Marry me, and I'll never look at another horse.
Those are my principles. If you don't like them, well, I have others.
She got her looks from her father. He's a plastic surgeon.
And finally, please accept my resignation. I don't care to belong to any club that would have me as a member.
It looks like we're up to J. There is so much to be said in favor of modern journalism. By giving us the opinion of the uneducated, it keeps us in touch with the ignorance of the community. Oscar Wilde.
Journalism consists largely in saying, Lord Jones died, to people who never knew Lord Jones was alive. G.K. Chesterton.
Journalism is the ability of meeting the challenge of filling space. Rebecca West.
The kiss originated when the first male reptile licked the first female reptile, implying, in a subtle, complimentary sort of way, that she was as succulent as the small reptile that he had had for dinner the night before.
Oh, knowledge. Men hate to be misunderstood, and to be understood makes them furious. Edgar Saltus.
Kindness. One can always be kind to people one knows nothing about. Oscar Wilde.
A lawyer. One trained in the circumvention of the law. Ambrose Bierce.
Liberals can't understand everything, but people who don't understand them... Lenny Bruce.
Liberty means responsibility. That's why most men dread it. George Bernard Shaw. Before we go on to another curmudgeon, I've been wondering, what makes someone a curmudgeon? Richard, what do you think?
I'm still thinking about what you want to do with my birthday.
Don't worry. Just enjoy and think of different kinds of presents you could get if your birthday falls on National Curmudgeon Day.
You mean like sour fruit balls? Cabbage Patch dolls, hot cross buns, and Speedos?
Hey, that might be neat.
For somebody over 50?
Why not?
And in my condition?
Hold it, guys. Here is a good example of what we've been talking about.
We've been talking about Speedos?
Think of the Aesop story of the fox and the grapes.
Okay, the fox goes out and sees a vine full of nice, tasty grapes.
Or so he thinks.
Right. He thinks they are tasty and tries to jump up and get some.
He tries and tries but can't quite jump high enough.
So, does he think of another way of reaching them?
No, he gives up.
And?
And decides that he really didn't want them anyway because they were probably too sour to eat.
I see. Tasty grapes.
Good idea.
I'll get some.
Better idea.
I can't reach them.
They weren't any good anyway.
Thus is born the curmudgeon.
Moral? It's easy to despise what we cannot attain.
Okay. We won't give the old curmudgeon Speedos for his birthday.
30 years ago, maybe, but not today.
What else might create a curmudgeon?
Well, besides just sour grapes, as was the case with the fox, maybe the ability to see through things that might be called mass movements or just plain cases of mass hysteria.
For instance?
How about an event that occurred in the state of Washington in 1954?
What happened then?
In late March, people began getting reports of tiny pit holes in windshields around the town of Bellingham.
I remember this. They were about the size of BBs, and police thought they were the work of vandals.
Within a week, reports came in from 25 miles away, same damage.
By the first week in April, more reports were coming in from farther away, even from an island. Police tried setting up roadblocks and inspecting travelers for evidence of the vandalism.
Nothing, right?
Right. But what did become clear, this was not the act of some roving band of hooligans, and it was approaching Seattle.
On April 14th, the Seattle newspapers ran a front-page stories. By 6 p.m., reports started coming in.
Lots of them?
3,000 by the next morning.
Mm.
Calls went out to the Washington governor and even to President Eisenhower.
Who was doing it?
Think just a minute, Bob. No cases reported in Seattle. Front-page ads run. In one day, 3,000 reports.
So somebody had to be doing it.
Experts from the Environmental Research Lab of the University of Washington arrived on the scene. Here were people from the applied physics, chemistry, and meteorology departments.
Well, what did they discover?
Cars pitted in the front, but not the back. Older car damaged, while new cars on the same lot undamaged. Residue on the windshields about the pit marks were from coal dust that had been flying around in Seattle air for years.
What was the cause then?
Normal wear and tear. Regular road use until someone called attention. And then...
panic.
Final report. 5% vandalism from copycat. 95% mass hysteria. Within 2 days, all reports of windshield damage ceased.
Who's the curmudgeon?
Dr. D. M. Ritter, one of the chemists doing the investigation. He said, "Tommy Rot, there isn't anything I know of that could be causing any unusual breaks in windshields. These people must be dreaming."
But that kind of behavior isn't unusual, is it?
From the Salem witch trials to any situation where people want someone to blame more than they want the truth.
Well, at least we can learn from our mistakes.
We learn from experience that men never learn anything from experience. George Bernard Shaw.
While I think about it, could you tell me a non-curmudgeon story?
I think we can do that. A new theme hotel was opened that catered to the intellectual crowd. It was patterned after philosophers or philosophies, so every room was decorated as befitting a different philosophical persuasion. For instance, you could stay in the room dedicated to Schopenhauer, or Rousseau, or Aristotle.
Or you could try the optimist suite.
Look at all these glasses. They're all half full.
Or you could stay in the pessimist suite.
Look at all these glasses. Just as I expected, they're all half empty.
Or you could stay in the realist forum where all the glasses were half the size of the other glasses.
Isn't this wonderful? All my glasses are just right.
A couple of philosophy majors, recently married, thought it would be quite the thing to enjoy a honeymoon at this establishment, so they booked reservations at the hotel.
I didn't know philosophers could have reservations. They're always so sure of themselves.
Quiet. Anyway, they specifically chose the Nietzsche decor.
Something about the Superman theme, no doubt.
And when they arrived, they discovered that there had been an assumption made, unsupported by proper empirical thinking, resulting in a faulty conclusion bordering on the epic proportions of a Hegelian synthesis being transformed into a Marxian manifesto.
In other words, they had no room.
But we were counting on the Nietzsche suite for our honeymoon.
I'm sorry, ma'am, but it is unavailable.
We had reservations.
Are you sure?
Would I lie to you?
Insufficient information to draw a conclusion.
All right, nevertheless, I think that we are here, and since we are here, we need a room. What else is available?
I'm sorry, all philosophies are taken for the night. There is nothing available.
But it's our honeymoon. We must stay within the aura of some philosopher's atmosphere.
There are some study groups that might be able to squeeze you into a theoretical hypothesis corner.
It's our honeymoon.
Yes, yes, I see, quite. Most of the study groups are platonic.
We reserved a private philosophy. Isn't there something you can do?
Can't.
Can't?
Can't.
Are you positive?
That is a categorical imperative.
I think I prefer the curmudgeons.
Okay, M. Man is a clever animal that behaves like an imbecile. Albert Schweitzer.
A memorandum is written not to inform the reader, but to protect the writer. Dean Acheson.
Marriage is popular because it combines the maximum of temptation with the maximum of opportunity. George Bernard Shaw.
New York, where everyone mutinies, but no one deserts. Harry Hirschfield.
Oh, noise. The amount of noise which anyone can hear undisturbed stands in inverse proportion to his mental capacity. Arthur Schopenhauer.
Nonconformity. Woe to him inside a nonconformist clique who does not conform with nonconformity. Eric Hoffer.
On being okay. I'm not okay and you're not okay. And that's okay. William Sloan Coffin.
Own opera. When an opera star sings her head off, it usually improves her appearance. Victor Borga.
On other people. Most people are other people. Their thoughts are someone else's opinions. Their lives a mimicry. Their passions a quotation. Oscar Wilde.
On others. Those who lack the courage will always find a philosophy to justify it. Ambrose Bierce.
A good politician is as unthinkable as an honest burglar. H. L. Mencken.
A pessimist thinks everyone is as nasty as himself and hates him for it. George Bernard Shaw.
And now a closer look at George Bernard Shaw. He was born in Dublin in July of 1856. His father was an unsuccessful grain merchant and sometimes civil servant. His mother was a professional singer. When he was about 16, his mother left home, following her voice teacher to London. He remained with his father until 1876, at which time he also moved to be with his mother.
Through his reading, he became an ardent socialist, and he was extremely annoyed by what he perceived to be an exploitation of the working class. He was also extremely critical of education. On education, he said, "Those who can, do. Those who can't, teach." And also, schools and schoolmasters, as we have them today, are not pauperous places of education and teachers, but rather prisons and turnkeys in which children are kept to prevent them from disturbing and chaperoning their parents.
Though a successful playwright himself, he was highly critical of some other dramatic effects, especially a practice of the time of cutting Shakespeare in order to create acting versions. Of Sir Henry Irving, he said, "He would have expiated his acting version on a scaffold. He not only merely cuts plays, he disembowels them. In Cymbeline, he has quite surpassed himself by extirpating the third verse of a famous dirge. A man who could do this would cut the coda from the first movement of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, or shorten one of Velasquez Phillips into a Kit Kat to make it fit over his drawing board."
And so, to other insights of George Bernard Shaw. A fool's brain digests philosophy into folly, science into superstition, and art into pedantry. Hence, university education.
A life making mistakes is not only more honorable, but more useful than a life spent doing nothing.
Gambling promises the poor what property performs for the rich, something for nothing.
If all economists were laid end to end, they would not reach a conclusion.
The liar's punishment is not in the least that he is not believed, but that he cannot believe anyone else.
Self-sacrifice enables us to sacrifice other people without blushing.
Martyrdom is the only way a man can become famous without ability.
The lack of money is the root of all evil.
Criminals do not die by the hands of the law. They die by the hands of other men.
We leave George Bernard Shaw and go on to R. Rat races. The trouble with rat races is that even if you win, you're still a rat. Lily Tomlin.
The rich aren't like us. They pay less taxes. Peter DeVries.
Look for the ridiculousness in everything, and you'll find it. Jules Renard.
Santa Claus has the right idea. Visit people once a year. Victor Borga.
Suburbia is where the developers' bulldozers outnumber the trees, and then they name the streets after them. Bill Vaughn.
It's not enough to succeed. Others must fail. Gore Vidal.
The pure and simple truth is rarely pure and never simple. Oscar Wilde.
Television, a medium. So-called because it's neither rare nor well done. Ernie Kovacs.
Theology is the attempt to explain the unknowable in terms of the not worth knowing. H.L. Mencken. Mencken, a world-class curmudgeon.
I agree. And yet, the first of our list of curmudgeons who didn't seem to have had an unhappy childhood. Now, he was born in Baltimore in September of 1880 to a middle-class German family. He described himself as a larva of the comfortable and complacent bourgeoisie. We were encapsulated with affection and kept fat, saucy, and contented.
His father owned and managed a cigar-making factory and imbued his son with a belief in the efficacy of independent action and thought and instilled in him a love for reading. He early followed in his father's business but really wanted to become a reporter. And when his father died and his uncle took over the business, he set out to become a newspaperman.
In 1899, he started his career in journalism with some trial assignments for the Baltimore Morning Herald. Within a few months, he was a full reporter, and by 1903, the editor, and by 1905, the editor of the Evening Herald. In 1906, he moved to the Baltimore Sun, and finally, in 1924, became the editor of the Mercury.
He became known as one of the most influential of social critics, and he especially skewered American society. Among other things, he was the originator of the phrase, the monkey trial, referring to the Scopes trial in Tennessee. Because of his attacks on the American social scene, he was often criticized and asked the question,
if you find so much that is unworthy of reverence in the United States, why do you live here?
His answer, why do men go to the zoo?
He held pomposity, incompetence, and pedantry in utter contempt. He believed in the right to speak your mind in all times and in all places. He abominated Baptists and Methodists, detested radio and television. He abhorred liberals and the Troy plutocracy, the rabble and the uplifters equally. He considered himself to be the spokesman for the civilized minority.
He attacked anything that he considered inimical to the freedom of the artist, and once described his function as stirring up the animals. He once said, all men are frauds. The only difference is that some admit it. I myself deny it. With this in mind, we have a little opinion piece that did not come from H.L. Mencken, but we think he would have agreed with it if he were alive. The subject is bloggers.
The very idea that everyone has the right to publicly air their petty opinions for the whole world to view, I find abominable. After reading some of these so-called informed opinions, not only should most of them never be aired, they should never even have been thought. I firmly believe that only experts should be allowed to speak publicly on societal issues. My problem is that as of yet, I have not found an expert that I agree with.
And with that, some things that H.L. Mencken really did say. Democracy is the theory that the common people know what they want and deserve to get it good and hard.
Democracy is the art of running the circus from the monkey cage.
A celebrity is a person who is well known to many persons and he is glad that he doesn't know.
Any person who afflicts the human race with ideas must be prepared to see them misunderstood.
Giving every man a vote has no more made men wise than Christianity has made them good.
It is even harder for the average ape to believe that he has descended from man.
In the United States, doing good has come to be, like patriotism, a favorite device of persons with something to sell.
It is hard to believe that a man is telling the truth when you know that you would lie if you were in his place.
A dull man is always sure. The sure man is always dull.
I never lecture, not because I am shy, but because I detest the kinds of people who go to lectures and I don't want to meet them.
A judge is a law student who marks his own papers.
It is inaccurate to say that I hate everything. I am strongly in favor of common sense, common honesty, and common decency. This makes me forever ineligible for public office.
And with that, we come to you. On the USA, America had often been discovered before Columbus, but it had always been hushed up. Oscar Wilde.
On understanding, the more I get to know man, the more I find myself loving dogs. Charles de Gaulle.
On the unimaginative, consistency is the last refuge of the unimaginative. Oscar Wilde.
My only aversion to vice is the price. Victor Buono.
Vegetables are interesting, but lack a sense of purpose when unaccompanied by a good cut of meat. Fran Lebowitz.
I never voted for anybody. I always voted against. W.C. Fields.
In this world, nothing is sure but death and taxes. Benjamin Franklin.
I prefer the wicked to the foolish. The wicked sometimes rest. Alexander Dumas.
I do not like work, even when someone else does it.
Which brings us to our final fine example of a curmudgeon, Samuel Clemens, better known as Mark Twain, born with the passing of Halley's Comet in 1835 and deceased with the passing of Halley's Comet some 75 years later in 1910.
He was born in Missouri, the sixth of seven children, of whom three died by early childhood. His father died when he was 11, and the next year he was apprenticed as a printer's assistant. When he was 18, he left Hannibal, Missouri, and worked as a printer at various times in New York, Philadelphia, St. Louis, and Cincinnati.
In the mid-1850s, Twain was taking a boat ride down the Mississippi from St. Louis to New Orleans. A steamboat pilot named Bixby inspired him to become a pilot himself. He studied the river for 2 years and finally got his pilot's license in 1859. During his training on the river, Twain convinced his younger brother Henry to come work on the river, a decision that turned out badly when Henry was killed in a boat explosion in 1858. He continued working as a pilot on the river until 1861, when the Civil War broke out, which curtailed passenger traffic.
When Twain left the river, he followed his older brother Orion to Nevada and tried his hand at silver mining in Virginia City.
Seems like he was a long time trying to make up his mind on what to do for a living.
And the mining wasn't the answer. He failed at mining and went off to San Francisco in 1864 to take up journalism again. Though he had some stories published before, it was here that he had his first real success with the publication of The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County. It was published by the Saturday Press back in New York. A year later, he traveled to the Hawaiian Islands as a reporter for the Sacramento Union, and in 1867 he was sent on a trip to the Mediterranean, a trip that produced the work Innocents Abroad. It was on this trip that he met his future brother-in-law, Charles Langdon.
Charles showed Twain pictures of his sister, Olivia. They began corresponding upon Twain's return from overseas, and they were engaged in 1868. He returned to New York and married Olivia in 1870. He built a home in Hartford, Connecticut, but summered with his brother-in-law's family in Quarry Farm, New York, for 20 summers. It was there that he wrote Huckleberry Finn.
Of all the images we have of Twain in San Francisco and the mother lode of Central California and Tom Sawyer on the Mississippi, and he wrote them from the East Coast?
He spent only about 9 years of his life west of Missouri, and not only was Huckleberry Finn written from Quarry Farm, but also Tom Sawyer, The Prince and the Pauper, Life on the Mississippi, Connecticut Yankee, and the King Arthur's Court.
One other piece from Twain's background that we want to mention. There are stories told that Twain fought in the Civil War and that he left the army, on his own volition, to go to Nevada. One account is that he was a part of a volunteer unit in Missouri that dissolved itself after just 2 weeks. Those accounts seem to be based on a fictionalized story he once wrote entitled, A Private History of a Campaign That Failed. We say fictionalized because it is not known whether any part of that story is true or not, and it was certainly not meant to be historical. It was the mood of a small group of boys that is important in the story, and their group was certainly not a part of any official military unit. Here's a part of that story. You have heard from a great many people who did something in the war. Is it not right and fair that you listen a moment to one who started to do something in the war, but didn't? They ought to be allowed to state why they didn't do anything, and to explain the process by which they didn't do anything. I was visiting a small town in which my boyhood had been spent, Hannibal, Marion County. Several of us got together in a secret place by night and formed ourselves into a military company. One Tom Lyman, a young fellow of a good deal of spirit, but no military experience, was made captain. I was made second lieutenant. We had no first lieutenant. I don't know why. It was a long time ago. By the advice of an innocent connected with the organization, we called ourselves the Marion Rangers. I do not remember that anyone found fault with that name. I didn't. Now, we approached a log farmhouse where, according to report, there was a guard of 5 Union soldiers. Lyman called a halt, and there in the deep gloom of the overhanging branches, he began to whisper a plan of assault upon the house, which made the gloom more depressing than it was before. It was a crucial moment. We were standing face to face with actual war. We were equal to the occasion. In our response, there was no hesitation, no indecision. We said that if Lyman wanted to meddle with those soldiers, he could go right ahead and do it. But if he wanted us to follow him, he would wait a long time. We had 2 more hours of dull trudging and ultimate silence and depression. About dawn, we straggled into New London, soiled, heel-blistered, and fagged from our little march. We stacked our shabby old shotguns in Colonel Rawl's barn, and then went in a body, and breakfasted with that veteran of the Mexican War. Afterwards, he took us to a distant meadow, and there in the shade of a tree we listened to an old-fashioned speech full of gunpowder and glory, which was regarded as eloquence in that ancient time. And then, later in their campaign, when the movement was completed, each man knew he was not the only person who crept to the front wall and had his eye at a crack between the logs. Presently a muffled sound caught our ears, and we recognized it as the hoofbeats of a horse. I got hold of a gun in the dark and pushed it through a crack between the logs, dazed with fright. Somebody said, "Fire!" And I pulled the trigger. I saw the man fall down out of the saddle. Somebody said, hardly audibly, "Good! We got him! Wait for the rest!" But the rest did not come. We waited, listened. Still, no more came. Then, wondering, we crept stealthily out and approached the man. When we got to him, the moon revealed him distinctly. He was lying on his back with his arms abroad, his mouth was open, and his chest was heaving with long gasps. His white shirt was splashed with blood. The man was not in uniform, and he was not armed. He was a stranger in the country, and that's all we ever found out about him. And that's when the militia disbanded.
And so to some Twain quotes. "I wish to become rich so that I can instruct the people and glorify honest poverty a little, like those kind-hearted, fat, benevolent people do."
"When I was younger, I could remember everything, whether it happened or not."
"Noise proves nothing. Often a hen who has merely laid an egg cackles as if she laid an asteroid."
"Of all God's creatures, there is only one that cannot be made a slave of the lash. That one is the cat. If man could be crossed with a cat, it would improve man, but it would deteriorate the cat."
"The worst loneliness is to become uncomfortable with yourself."
"What is an ethical man? A Christian. Holding 4 aces."
"A man who does not read good books has no advantage over a man who cannot read them."
"Have a place for everything and keep the things somewhere else. That is not advice. That is merely custom."
"Good breeding is concealing how much we think of ourselves and how little we think of the other person."
"Get your facts first. Then you can distort them as much as you please."
"Why is it that we rejoice at a birth and grieve at a funeral? Is it because we are not the person involved?"
"Golf is a good walk. Ruined."
"All you need in this life is ignorance and confidence, and then success is sure."
"It is better to deserve honors and not have them than to have them and not deserve them."
"Each man must for himself decide which is right and which is wrong, which course is patriotic and which isn't. You cannot shirk this and be a man. To decide against your conviction is to be an unqualified and inexcusable traitor, both to yourselves and to your country. Let men label you as they may.
Man is really the most interesting jackass there is. You see, it's his idea that the deity sits up nights to admire him. He's the creator's pet. You know why? Because of his intellect, that's why. Man is a reasoning animal, or such is the claim. Myself, I've been studying this reasoning animal for years and find the results humiliating. Well, I guess you folks have just got to understand that man was created at the end of a week's worth.
I just thought of something else that might make a person a curmudgeon.
What's that?
Signs and announcement. Oh, not all signs and announcements. Some provide good information. But there are some out there that just make you go, brrr.
Can you give us an example?
I was in the deli shop of a grocery store some years ago, and there was a sign on the wall that said, persons under the age of 18 not allowed to use automatic slicing equipment. So, out of curiosity, I asked a girl, what if they did? If someone under the age of 18 used the automatic slice equipment, is there a sandwich board that would come and shut you down? She answered, we don't hire anyone under the age of 18. Store policy. Then why the sign?
In 2002, there was a poster on a bus in Manhattan which read, are you an adult who cannot read? If so, we can help.
In 2003, crossing guards who worked for the schools in Glasgow, Scotland, were sent letters that informed them that their paychecks could be sent to them in Braille, if they were blind.
I saw a sign just recently that said, ask about our senior coffee.
Did you?
No. I was afraid the clerk would say, this pot of coffee here is guaranteed to be 62 and a half years old.
The federal government announced it was worried about the long-term effects of medical marijuana on the terminally ill. All right, some last comments from curmudgeons. A cynic knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. Oscar Wilde.
Satire is a glass wherein beholders do generally discover everybody's face but their own. Jonathan Swift.
I've always been interested in people, but I've never liked them. W. Somerset Maugham.
Forgive, O Lord, my little jokes on thee, and I'll forgive thy great big one on me. Robert Frost.
I like long walks, especially when they're taken by people that annoy me. Fred Allen.
Sometimes you wake up in the morning and wish your parents had never met. Bill Fitch.
Idealism is what precedes experience. Cynicism is what follows. David Wolfe.
At 18, our convictions are hills from which we look. At 45, they are caves in which we hide. F. Scott Fitzgerald.
The ink of the scholar is more sacred than the blood of the martyr. Mohammed.
One of the penalties in refusing to participate in politics is that you end up being governed by your inferiors. Plato.
Do not bite at the hook of pleasure until you know there is no hook. Thomas Jefferson.
Most people are willing to pay more to be amused than to be educated. Robert Savage.
If 50 million people say a foolish thing, it is still a foolish thing. Anatole France.
Show me a sane man and I will cure him for you. Carl Jung.
A creative man is driven by the desire to achieve, not by the desire to beat others. Ayn Rand.
Any government that robs Peter to pay Paul can always depend on the support of Paul. George Bernard Shaw.
The urge to save humanity is almost always a ruse for the urge to rule. H.L. Mencken.
When people are free to do as they please, they usually imitate each other. Eric Hoffer.
It isn't the incompetent who destroy an organization. It is those who have achieved something and want to rest on their achievements who are forever clogging things up. Charles Sorensen.
Never attribute to malice what can be adequately explained by stupidity. Nick Diamos.
The only reason some people get lost in thought is because it's unfamiliar territory. Paul Fix.
Well, I think that brings us to Y, the end of the alphabet. Youth is a wonderful thing. What a shame to waste it on children. George Bernard Shaw.
What is youth but a man or woman before it is ready or fit to be seen? Evelyn Waugh.
Wait a minute. You said that brings us to the end of the alphabet. What about Z? And also, we didn't do anything for X or Q.
We left them out on purpose.
Why?
Well, let me explain. Remember we started the program by looking at King George III's diary? Well, if you would have turned the page, you would have read Q, X, and Z. Nothing of importance happened on these letters.
What do you mean, nothing of importance?
And then there's a footnote. See September 16th for further information.
And what does it say there?
Most modern calendars mar the sweet simplicity of our lives by reminding us that each day that passes is the anniversary of some perfectly uninteresting event. Oscar Wilde.
Well, what do you think, Richard?
About what?
About making September 16th National Curmudgeon's Day in honor of your birthday.
Well...
pretty good idea, don't you think?
Tell it to us from the heart. We'll use it as promotional when we publicize it.
Your birthday! Your slogan all over the country!
Richard Dunnigan brings you National Curmudgeon's Day!
So, what do you think?
I think I may have told you guys a lie.
You? Tell a lie?
What lie?
I was actually born on the 15th.
Oh, I just love it when he talks curmudgeon.
This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and thank you for listening in to another edition of Did You Know?
This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and airs weekly on Thursday at 9 p.m., Saturdays at noon, and Sunday evenings at 8.
Episodes of our program are also available as podcasts. Just go to our homepage on your computer, select the podcast section, and then click on Did You Know?
We wish to thank WRAL.com, which is part of the Raleigh-based Capital Broadcasting Company's new CBC New Media Group, for their sponsorship of Did You Know?
If any of our listeners might be able to help underwrite any of the programming of TRS, which is designed for the print and visually impaired, please call us at 919-832-5138.
Last comments. One from Mark Twain. Kindness is a language that even the deaf can hear and the blind can see.
The other from Helen Keller. When one door of happiness closes, another opens. But often we look so long at the closed door that we do not see the one which has been opened for us.
Until next week.
Goodbye.